This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
I see this administration as unfortunately hostile to that in ways that just don't make sense to me, irrespective of ideology. And so the direction I see the administration going is just simply not one that I believe fits with these core values and really these core opportunities for the United States to profit economically and be a global leader.
Recently, in response to the 45th president's shameful mishandling of the incidents in Charlottesville, Virginia, UC Berkeley energy professor Daniel Kammen resigned as a State Department Special Science Envoy. His resignation letter picked up national attention, in part because the first letter of each paragraph spelled out the word impeach. This week on Sea Change Radio, we hear from Professor Kammen, learn more about his role of special envoy, how it changed under the current administration, and some of the reasons why he felt the need to leave the post. Then we reach back to our 2015 discussion with Professor Kammen and hear about the strides that are being made to provide electricity to the 20% of the world's population that doesn't currently have access to it. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Daniel Kammen. Dan is a University of California at Berkeley energy professor. Dan, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me on.
So you've been on before and we've discussed global electricity issues and you've done some important work in that field. But most recently you've been in the news because you resigned an unpaid position at the State Department as a science envoy. Well, why don't you first explain what these science envoys are supposed to do?
So the Envoy program was established by President Obama, and it's designed to bring in a small number of subject area experts. I believe it's sort of 4 to 7 a year. And they are unpaid members of the team, if you will, but they are in their day job, whether they're professors or at companies in the private sector, but working with the State Department. And so my mission was on energy and climate change in Africa and the Middle East. And I focused on partnerships with Jordan, with Morocco, Kenya, and with the East African community more broadly of nations.
And why was it within the State Department and not something like the EPA?
So I've worked with both Department of Energy and EPA in the past, but what has happened over the last 8 years or so is that the State Department has ramped up a very significant presence in science and STEM. And there's a direct advisor to the Secretary of State. There's a number of elements of our overseas program. And in fact, the AAAS, the American Academy of Advancement of Science, helps the State Department and supports it with a scientist working within state to coordinate these efforts. Because, of course, the U.S. has a long history of innovation in science and technology and using that for economic growth, for the betterment of lives around the planet. And so this program really fits very naturally into that slot within the State Department. And for myself in particular, there's a second piece, and that is from 2010 to 2016, I had served in the State Department in a similar role with a focus on Latin America, the Caribbean, and North America. And that was called the ECPA, the Energy and Climate Partnership of the Americas. And I was appointed the first ECPA fellow in energy. And there were three, myself in energy, one in land use, and one in water.
And I'm interested in your workflow within this position. Obviously, you're a tenured professor, you're publishing, you're doing a lot of work in other areas. Can you maybe kind of give us an idea of what the day-to-day requirements of the envoy position are?
So the way that it works is that you arrange for overseas trips to support specific mission areas. And so in my case, working in the Middle East and Africa, you really can't make a few day trips. You need to plan for longer time. So I actually took a sabbatical from my work at Cal so that I could be really fully available for the State Department to support their efforts. And because of the success of the Paris Climate Accord and how rapidly and enthusiastically it was signed and moved into effect, the next meeting in that series that took place in November 2016 was in Morocco. And so Morocco was one of my target countries. And I spent a month in country and in region working with the U.S. delegation, getting ready for the meeting, working on a number of side events, partnering between U.S. companies, Moroccan companies, and between agencies in Morocco and the United States on clean energy deployment, on the efficient use of energy and water. And we established and set up a number of partnerships with specific Moroccan agencies, both their overall agency for sustainable energy called MASEN, but also their innovation-focused energy, IRASEN, as well as AME, which is the National Agency for Energy Efficiency. And so we set up really solid working partnerships there. We did similar efforts in Jordan, largely around the energy-water nexus, big concern, of course, in Jordan. And then in East Africa, we worked focally with Kenya, which is the informal hub of the East African power pool, the East African community of countries. But Kenya, like Morocco, is a huge regional leader in clean energy. And I brought my own experience, my own students, my own postdoctoral fellows, partners from other laboratories in the United States that worked on these topics to bear on these efforts. And so that was the sort of the overall frame. But the way the work would go in detail would be typically week to 10-day trips into the region to really set up partnerships, to help in establishing grant proposals that might go to international agencies, and to really facilitate that transition in each country.
Now, obviously, we're going to get to your now famous resignation letter in a second, but I first want to get to the transition period this fall when Donald Trump was elected president. How did your job change, if in any way?
Well, it really didn't. So in fact, on the election day in November, we were all at the climate conference in Marrakesh. And so, I mean, it came as, it was big news there, of course. And so it was talked about greatly. But my own work really did not change. For one reason, of course, President Obama was still in office until January 19th. And so many of the trips we'd set up for the middle of winter just went on as is. But even after that, the people I worked with within the State Department were fabulous, and we really had a very good working relationship. I observed no interference. The projects we did worked very well. We continued efforts with partnerships in country. And so there was no negative on the day-to-day working experience at all.
So let's get to your resignation letter. It sounds now from talking to you that the terms upon which you are leaving this position are much more ethical and personal than the fact that you weren't getting support from the State Department or any of your other colleagues with this new administration. Is that fair to say?
That's definitely right. I mean, I really thought that the day-to-day workings were great. However, that said, there were a number of events that led me to my letter and led me to a very clear a clear statement that my own task as science envoy was simply in conflict with the direction that Mr. Trump seemed to be going.
Why don't you walk us through those?
Okay. So the first of these events was, of course, the decision to for the U.S. to depart from the Paris Climate Accord, which was, after all, a voluntary agreement. And it's one that the U.S. played a very large role in successfully brokering as a milestone of international cooperation. And so that already was a huge concern to me, because it stood in such contradiction to the specific terms of my term as envoy to work on energy and climate as an overseas partnership. So one question I've been asked is, why didn't I resign the day that Trump pulled out of Paris Climate Accord? And the reason is I wanted to get to give the benefit of the doubt and to wait and see. some of the comments that Mr. Trump made with that announcement were that he would look for a different deal for the United States. And while I think that the deal the United States got was excellent in terms of jobs, in terms of international leadership, I wanted to see what would evolve. And it was very clear that essentially nothing was evolving. There was no effort to think about the Paris in new or more interesting, progressive, or other lights. So I was deeply concerned at that point. But then as we get to the immediate events, the president's response, or I would say mixed message response to the tragedy in Charlottesville was, in my view, an unacceptable position. While it was domestic, it definitely stood in strong opposition to what I believe is the mandate of the State Department and the envoy position to build partnerships and to find areas where we can bridge differences. And the president followed that up with comments in Arizona last week that further reinforced the fact that this idea of partnerships through science and technology was an area that the administration was supporting was simply not there. And then there's the broader piece, which is that this has been an administration that so far has really indicated a position very much against the positive role that science and technology can play in terms of talking about dramatic and some say draconian cuts to the budgets of the State Department, of the Department of Energy, and of the EPA. And I thought it was inconsistent for me to be doing this job, which I love and I would love to have continued, under an administration that was stepping away from all of those core values.
You write in the letter, "My decision to resign is in response to your attacks on core values of the United States." So this is the president himself. This is not anybody within the State Department or the administration. You're responding to these events that all of us look at kind of slack-jawed and just cannot understand how somebody who's elected president could be speaking in these terms. Is that fair to say?
That is. I'm disappointed because Democratic or Republican, and I have worked for both Democratic and Republican administrations in the White House before in my other advisory roles. But science and technology, STEM fields, innovation are a hallmark of the economic muscle of the United States. And I see this administration as unfortunately hostile to that in ways that just don't make sense to me, irrespective of ideology. And so the direction I see the administration going is just simply not one that I believe fits with these core values and really these core opportunities for the United States to profit economically and be a global leader.
So something you said that was, I think, a nice little dig there, because in your letter is the Trump administration keeps touting jobs. You know, sometimes he'll just tweet and at the end it'll just say jobs exclamation point. So this is kind of one of the things that he ran on, was he'll bring the jobs back in this very vague way.
Well, so this is one reason why I actually wanted to wait and see what happened after the decision on the Paris Climate Accord, because the jobs opportunities that come from being a leader in solar energy, wind power, energy storage, the integration of natural gas systems with renewables, these are all places where there's many academic groups from many different political leanings that see very large opportunities and benefits, quantified increases in jobs. Here in California, for example, there are now more people employed in the solar industry than in the big three utilities in the state. And so this is not an area of doubt. This is not an area where there's two economic sides to it. There's unambiguous evidence that investing in clean tech today is a jobs creator. And so that's another area that I was disappointed to see what seemed like an entirely partisan decision from the White House to not be a supporter of the Paris Climate Accord, of the emerging clean energy industry, even if you do so only because of the economic benefits to the United States, let alone this little minor issue of saving the planet.
And you also included a subliminal message in it. It was kind of an homage to a similarly penned letter that came out from the Committee on the Arts and Humanities, and they spelled out, the first letter of each paragraph spelled out the word resist. In your letter, the first letter of every paragraph spells out impeach. Why don't you explain the thinking behind that?
Well, so, I mean, I say that as a private citizen, right? I am not a member of the U.S. House of Representatives or the Senate, so my version of impeach is thankfully less formal than it might have to be, depending how far this goes.
Of course.
But my concern is that I do not see the actions from the White House as being what I would argue are in the best interest of the United States. Politics aside, I know it's hard to separate these two, but not investing in jobs, not investing in the global leadership opportunities are signs, in my view, of an administration that is off track. And so I put the message impeach in, as you say, to pay homage to the Arts Council that resigned en masse the week before, with resist as the message in their letter, in the acrostic, which is the first letter of each paragraph. But I also believe to this day that strong messages can have reverberation and there can be learning. And so, interestingly enough, this past weekend, Secretary Tillerson on the Sunday talk shows went on and said a remarkable statement. He said that the president speaks for himself, a.k.a. the president does not speak for everyone on issues, and he was referring to Charlottesville. So that was an interesting statement in itself. I wanted to be as clear in my condemnation of the president's actions around Charlottesville, around the Paris Climate Accord, as I could, but I do hold out hope that we do not need to go to what I view as a destructive process. Impeachment is not good for any side. And if the president is interested to learn from the resignations of not just myself, of the Arts Council, of his Council on Business Competitiveness, there's a number of groups that are voicing similar thoughts that we need to take a different tact on both domestic and international leadership for our benefit in the United States and for the global benefit as well.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Daniel Kamen. He's a professor of energy at the University of California at Berkeley.
So your last assessment that you hope that your letter and other letters of resignation will make an impact and resonate with this president, who will hopefully learn from people like yourself leaving the administration. I think that that's maybe overly generous, or maybe you're being more optimistic than I am. I don't think a man in his 70s who's never expressed any real kindness or empathy in a public forum to anybody is all of a sudden going to kind of have a light bulb moment and decide to be a more empathetic, rational person. But hope springs eternal. I want to discuss a hypothetical. If you are sitting around in a room with some of the other administration officials who have also expressed dismay at what this president is doing, people like you just mentioned, Secretary Rex Tillerson, recently Gary Cohn apparently drafted a resignation letter, leaked it to the press, and then I guess took a step back. So these people are trying to walk a very fine line in sticking with the administration while still being appalled by some of the behavior. How do you think that conversation might go with a Gary Cohn or Rex Tillerson if you were in a candid moment? Do you think that they're actually enabling this president, or do you think that them sticking by him despite their protests are effective?
Obviously, those individuals and I don't agree on a whole range of issues, but I think that we all do agree that there is a higher calling as president. There's an opportunity and a need to rise above some of the local politics and to learn. And I actually believe that it doesn't matter what your age is, in your teens, in your 70s, that people can dramatically learn if given the right stimulus. And so I do think that the points that you highlight from Cohn and from Tillerson, sort of unlikely bedfellows, if you will, with someone like myself, are sending a message that this is a chance to be presidential and this is a chance to rise to the level that we expect irrespective of ideology. And I think that message is one that kind of those people in the conversation might be able to highlight. And obviously, I've taken a different stance than they have. They still serve in the administration. But I think that there is a need and a growing voice to really reform one's behavior to really better reflect the values of and to support the United States.
Fair enough. So politics aside, why don't you explain a recent study that you and your colleagues have been exploring in terms of energy storage prices. They're falling faster than we expected. A couple years ago, we were looking at some of the electricity prices around the globe, and there's some very positive news coming out. Why don't you summarize for our listeners?
There really is positive news on the energy storage front. And something that my students and I have been studying for two decades is what leads to innovation. Is it just investment in research and development? Is it markets? Is it some combination? Is it sort of high profile innovative technologies or syntheses of technologies such as perhaps Tesla or something does? And what we found by looking in quite a bit of analytic detail is that we're able to really build a model that not only shows that as you manufacture more of a technology, its prices fall if you can mass produce it, but in particular, the clear signs of innovation. And so we see patents in a given area, we see research and development dollars being spent in conjunction with markets opening up, driving in particular storage to innovate as fast or faster than we've seen from either wind or solar. And so it's a really exciting time because if we start to think about baseload clean energy, the opportunity here is to think about solar and wind, geothermal, other technologies combined with lots of storage to give us a cost-effective way to get to really low, if not entirely decarbonized economies. And that's what our paper last month in Nature Energy found.
And we'll link to that in seachangeradio.com. Daniel Kamen, he's a professor of energy at the University of California at Berkeley. Dan, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Now here's part of my 2015 discussion with Professor Daniel Kamen. This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Daniel Kamen. He's a professor of energy at UC Berkeley. So if this vision comes true, and the lights go on all over the globe, the short term, if it's clean energy, renewable energy, that should be great. We can get our greenhouse gas emissions down and people will become more educated and there'll be less oppression in the world. But from a longer term perspective, what happens if we have just this population boom and an industrial revolution that goes along with it, which may not have as many clean energy solutions? Or are you confident that the technology will have caught up by the time people in sub-Saharan Africa are ready to drive cars, that these cars are all be electric cars?
There's two questions embedded in this. One is, where are we going population-wise, which we can only forecast, we don't know for sure, and is the clean energy resource large enough to meet all these needs? And population, big mystery, controversial topic, but the energy resources to meet the needs of today's population worldwide and potentially where we're going, which could be 9 to 11 billion, is there. The clean energy resource is large enough. Do we need new market mechanisms and a great expansion of the interconnection technology to bring it to everyone? We do, but we're already seeing in the cases of distributed microenergy with hydropower in
in Bhutan, and large amounts of solar and biomass in East Africa, and distributed wind in Central Europe, we are already seeing that clean energy resource is certainly large enough to meet the needs, but it takes a level of interconnectivity of a grid system, whether it's local or regional, a so-called smart grid, to make it happen. Whether we will build that smart energy system fast enough so that we can rely on clean energy, or whether we rely on natural gas and coal, is the question. And what we see is, on a climate basis, we cannot rely on those fossil systems, even though they look like simpler opportunities. You need to meet a lot of people's energy needs, build a big coal plant. Well, we see the health and the environmental downsides of that often trumping the energy you would get out of it. And in fact, we've seen a number of places where you can build the clean energy system, solar, wind, biomass, much more rapidly and serve more people more immediately than waiting for a big coal plant. And so if you focus your system on this clean energy agenda, what we found in this paper is that you really can beat fossil fuels at the game of not just providing access, but providing it more rapidly than you would get from the old energy system.
So this may lead to a little bit too much of an inside baseball explanation, but in terms of your methodologies and you're breaking down a country's success in transitioning to clean energy, what are some of the bellwether metrics that you look at? What is the litmus test for seeing that a country's on the right path? Is it lack of coal, or is it producing X amount of gigawatts from solar?
I actually find that it's that the amount of fossil fuel resource is the poorest indicator, because ultimately much of that fossil fuel has to be left in the ground. So I often say that the long term, the best use of those fossil fuels is to keep the ground up and leave them in the ground. They are in the long term not the best resource. In some places, they're not the best resource right now. In East Africa, geothermal power plus solar is cheaper than the fossil fuel options. Not with some subsidy, but cheaper today, flat out.
Do they have an option, or you mean cheaper for a government?
No, I mean cheaper, period, no footnotes, no caveats. The cheapest form of new energy generation in Kenya is geothermal, and it's 8 cents a kilowatt hour. Diesel, which is their backup option today, is 35 cents, so it's not even close. So with the same dollar, whether it's national money or developed money, geothermal, easy answer.
On a grid level, or is this on a
even
community?
Even distributed. There are small-scale geothermal that cost around 10 or 12, and there's large-scale geothermal.
10 or 12 what?
Cents per kilowatt hour.
Okay.
That's the same cost as electricity in California.
Yeah, that's what solar costs.
That's right. And so what we're saying is that geothermal is cheaper than fossil. Solar is cheaper than fossil. Wind is not easy from household to household, but the largest wind farm in Africa is going in Kenya. So there are places today already where, even though Kenya also has large amounts of coal and they've discovered oil recently, they have uranium, that this is a place where the renewables actually just win out pure on economics. Now, that doesn't mean that a given government is going to choose that route, because we're used to the old style energy system. But the pure economics favor renewables. And ironically, in many places, the issue is how quickly can you bring energy access to people in rural areas? And it's a fact that it's faster to bring these distributed cleaner systems than to wait to build big infrastructure for coal or natural gas. And so the economics and the resource mix favor clean energy, but our economic system is largely tied to the old world, and that favors incumbents. And the incumbents are coal, oil, and big hydro. And so the transition is possible, but it takes leaders with innovative policies. And so places like Kenya and Bangladesh and Nicaragua have made very clear efforts to favor renewables in terms of bringing power to the people. And those places that have set up clear policies are seeing that transition move much quicker than places that have not set up that kind of vision around green energy.
Professor Daniel Kamen, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio.
Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by The Budos Band and Los Lobos.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.